Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 10, On Paul. Watchman's Teaching Letter Number 124, August 2008. From the 2008 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emmaheiser. Read by Dan Adams. This is my 124th monthly teaching letter and continues my 11th year of publication. This is another in a series on the Apostle Paul. Lesson number 123 was a preparatory lesson on what I am about to address in this one. In that lesson, I compared the King James Version to George M. Lamps's translation on Leviticus 18, 2-5 and 21, 29-30, Leviticus 19, 19, Leviticus 20, 2-5. We discovered there was a lot of difference between the King James Version giveth of his seed unto Moloch, and Lamps's rendering, man who has cast his semen into an alien woman. I proceeded in that lesson to give the backgrounds of George M. Lamsa and the Syriac Aramaic versions. After some research, it was discovered that Lamsa condemned the King James Version translators for their ignorance, saying, the 16th century translators of the Holy Bible did not understand the idioms of the languages from which they translated. Therefore, they translated idioms literally and their true meanings were lost. They translated many Eastern idioms and metaphors literally, not knowing their true meaning. End quote. From this, we can envision why Lamsa translated Leviticus chapters 18 through 20 as he did, for he obviously considered these passages to contain Hebrew idioms. In order to understand some of the Hebrew metaphors of the Bible, it will be necessary to go to Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 6, verses 14 through 18. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial, that is, someone worthless? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For ye are the temple of the living God, as God hath said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore, come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith Yahweh, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father unto you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith Yahweh Almighty. Some would have us believe that Paul, in writing to the Corinthians, was addressing heathen Gentiles, which simply is not true. Such inferences are made only by blind leaders of the blind. All one need do is to go to the beginning of chapter 6 to see the language Paul used at verse 2, which says, For he saith, I have heard thee in a time accepted, and in the day of salvation have I succored thee. Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. I don't know about your Bible, but mine cross-references this verse to Isaiah 49:8. So let's go there and see who Isaiah was addressing. From verses 1 through 5, Isaiah recalls his commission. Then from verses 6 through 8, Isaiah identifies who he was addressing thusly. And he said, It is a light thing that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob, and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the nations, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth. Thus saith Yahweh, the Redeemer of Israel and his Holy One, to him whom man despiseth, to him whom the nation abhorreth, to a servant of rulers, kings shall see and arise, princes also shall worship, because of Yahweh, that is faithful, and the Holy One of Israel, and he shall choose thee. Thus saith Yahweh, In an acceptable time have I heard thee, and in a day of salvation have I helped thee, and I will preserve thee, and give thee for a covenant of the people to establish the earth, to cause to inherit the desolate heritages, that thou mayest say to the prisoners, Go forth to them that are in darkness. Show yourselves. They shall feed in the ways, and their pastors shall be in all high places. Thus it becomes quite obvious here from Paul's language at 2 Corinthians 6:2 that he was addressing the same people that Isaiah was identifying at Isaiah 49:6 to raise up the tribes of Jacob. Had the Corinthians been other than Israelites, Paul would have been quite foolish for citing Isaiah 49:8 to them. But Paul saw in the Corinthians Isaiah's fulfillment. In an acceptable time have I heard thee, and in a day of salvation have I helped thee, and I will preserve thee and give thee for a covenant of the people. Now that we know that Paul was addressing Israelites when writing to the Corinthians, we can go on to examine 2 Corinthians 6:14 through 18. William Fink, in his Letters of Paul, translates verse 14 thusly, Do not become yoked together with untrustworthy aliens. Fink's footnote on this passage reads in part, The opening sentence of this verse is very difficult to translate in few words, although it only contains four Greek words. Greek words is here, Do not become yoked together with untrustworthy aliens. The Authorized Version has here, Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. And so many interpret this to be a religious statement, which would have Paul conflict with his own statements, such as those at 1 Corinthians 7:12 through 14, and so be a liar. This is not a religious statement, as will be evident upon examination of the terms Greek word 2086 and Greek word 571. End quote. There are different ways an Israelite can become yoked together with untrustworthy aliens: by marriage, in unlawful fornication, race mixing, by social activities, by business relations, by religion, or by any endeavor with a common goal. The King James Version's Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers suggests language found at Deuteronomy 22:9-11. Thou shalt not sow thy vineyard with diverse seeds, lest the fruit of thy seed which thou hast sown, and the fruit of thy vineyard be defiled. Thou shalt not plough with an ox and an ass together. Thou shalt not wear a garment of diverse sorts, as of woolen and linen together. These are common sense ordinances to be observed. If it is not sanctioned to sow a vineyard with diverse seed, because it will bring forth defiled fruit, how much more should sowing diverse seed among our races be avoided, as the fruit, child, will also be defiled? You will notice that verses 9 through 11 of Deuteronomy 22 are all grouped together, and all have the same connotation. At verse 10, we are admonished not to plow with an ox and an ass, yoked as a team. This verse is intimating more than it appears. To apply it literally, two men of a different race should not work together at the same job. Otherwise, the outcome will be a nigger-rigged product. Likewise, a sexual yoking with two of unlike race will bring forth a nigger-rigged product. At verse 11, we are admonished not to weave a garment of woolen and linen together. The first time a person would try to wash such a garment, the fibers of the wool and linen would shrink disproportionately, ending in a badly misshapen, unusable clump of tangled knots. The solution to the problem, weave linen into cloth for undergarments, and weave wool into cloth for outer garments. The undergarment could be washed, which becomes dirty more quickly from bodily fluids and the shedding of dry skin. By wearing the wool cloth for outer garments, one could, if careful, wear them for a long time before they need cleaning. In modern times, some of these fabric problems have been solved by pre-shrinking the threads to be woven and dry cleaning the outer garments. But I believe that the admonition not to weave linen and wool together has the greater meaning, as an example not to mix one's race. I believe that is also the inference at Leviticus 18:2-5 and 21 and 29 and 30, Leviticus 19:19, and Leviticus 22-5 discussed in the last lesson. It is amazing how modern science, when understood correctly, is proving the Bible correct in every detail. There is a genetic difference between an ox and a donkey, and there are genetic differences between the races. For this, I will go to the Collier's Encyclopedia, Volume 4, page 180, under the heading Modern Biological Concepts, and the subtopic Cell Doctrine. Cell Doctrine, one of the broadest and most fundamental biological generalizations, is the Cell Doctrine. This includes the concepts that all living things, both animal and plant, are composed of cells and cell products, that new cells are formed by the division of pre-existing cells, that there are basic similarities in the chemical constituents and metabolic activities of all cells, and that the activity of an organism as a whole is the sum of the activities and interactions of its independent units. Genetic mechanisms and evolution. The gene theory states that the characteristics of each generation are transmitted to the next by the units of inheritance known as genes. The genes are composed of deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. The large complex molecules of DNA are made up of four kinds of subunits called nucleotides, which are arranged in a double helix. The information in each gene resides in the particular order of these subunits. Since each gene is composed of 10,000 or so nucleotides arranged in some specific sequence, there are very large number of possible combinations of nucleotides, and therefore a large number of different sequences representing different bits of genetic information. The information in each gene is translated from one generation to the next by a code called the genetic code, which involves the linear sequence of the four nucleotide units making up the gene. In each cell generation, the gene undergoes replication, so that when the cell divides, each of the two daughter cells gets an exact copy of the code. Also, in each cell generation, one or more transcriptions of the code may be made by which the genetic information is used to regulate the assembly of a specific enzyme or protein. End quote. From Wikipedia on the Internet, deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, is a nucleic acid that contains the genetic instructions used in the development and functioning of all known living organisms and some viruses. The main role of DNA molecules is the long-term storage of information. DNA is often compared to a set of blueprints or a recipe, since it contains the instructions needed to construct other components of cells, such as proteins and RNA molecules. The DNA segments that carry this genetic information are called genes, but other DNA sequences have structural purposes and are involved in regulating the use of this genetic information. Chemically, DNA is a long polymer of simple units called nucleotides, with a backbone made of sugars and phosphate groups joined by ester bonds. Attached to each sugar is one of four types of molecules called bases. It is the sequence of these four bases along the backbone that encodes information. This information is read using the genetic code, which specifies the sequence of the amino acids within proteins. The code is read by copying stretches of DNA into the related nucleic acid RNA in a process called transcription. Within cells, DNA is organized into structures called chromosomes. These chromosomes are duplicated before cells divide in a process called DNA replication. Eukaryotic organisms animals, plants, and fungi store their DNA inside the cell nucleus, while in prokaryotes, bacteria, and archaea, it is found in the cell's cytoplasm. Within the chromosomes, chromatin proteins, such as histones, compact and organize DNA. These compact structures guide the interrelations between DNA and other proteins, helping control which parts of the DNA are transcribed. End quote. Introduction to Genetics from Wikipedia. A section of DNA, the sequence of the plate-like units, nucleotides, in the center carries information. This article is intended as a generally accepted introduction to the subject. Genetics studies show how living organisms inherit many of the features of their ancestors. For example, children usually look and act like other people in their family. Genetics tries to identify which features are inherited and work out the details of how these features are passed from generation to generation. In genetics, a feature of an organism is called a trait. Some traits are features of an organism's physical appearance, for example, a person's eye color, height, or weight. There are many other types of traits, and these range from aspects of behavior to resistance to disease. Traits and other inherited, for example, tall and thin people, tend to have tall and thin children. Other traits come from the interaction between inherited features and the environment. For example, a child might inherit the tendency to be tall, but if there is very little food where they live and they are poorly nourished, they will still be short. The way genetics and environment interact to produce a trait can be complicated. For example, the chances of somebody dying of cancer or heart disease seem to depend on both their family history and their lifestyle. Genetic information is carried by a long molecule called DNA, and this DNA is copied and inherited across generations. Traits are carried in DNA as instructions for constructing and operating an organism. These instructions are contained in segments of DNA called genes. DNA is made of a sequence of simple units, with the order of these units spelling out instructions in the genetic code. This is similar to the orders of letters spelling out words. The organism reads the sequence of these units and decodes the instruction. Not all the genes for a particular instruction are exactly the same. Different forms of one type of gene are called different alleles of that gene. As an example, one allele of a gene for hair color could carry the instruction to produce a lot of the pigment in black hair, while a different allele could give a garbled version of this instruction so that no pigment is produced and the hair is white. Mutations are random events that change the sequence of a gene and therefore create a new allele. Mutations can produce a new trait, such as turning an allele for black hair into an allele for white hair. End quote. Genetics from Wikipedia. Genetics, a discipline of biology, is the science of heredity and variation in living organisms. The fact that living things inherit traits from their parents has been used since prehistoric times to improve crop plants and animals through selective breeding. However, the modern science of genetics, which seeks to understand the process of inheritance, only began with the work of Gregor Mendel in the mid-19th century. Although he did not know the physical basis for heredity, Mendel observed that organisms inherit traits in a discrete manner. These basic units of inheritance are now called genes. DNA, the molecular basis for inheritance. Each strand of DNA is a chain of nucleotides matching each other in the center to form what look like rungs on a twisted ladder. Genes correspond to regions within DNA, a molecule composed of a chain of four different types of nucleotides. The sequence of these nucleotides is the genetic information organisms inherit. DNA naturally occurs in a double-stranded form, with nucleotides on each strand complementary to each other. Each strand can act as a template for creating a new partner strand. This is the physical method for making copies of genes that can be inherited. The sequence of nucleotides in a gene is translated by cells to produce a chain of amino acids, creating proteins. The order of amino acids in a protein corresponds to the order of nucleotides in the gene. This is known as the genetic code. The amino acids in a protein determine how it folds into a three-dimensional shape. This structure is, in turn, responsible for the protein's function. Proteins carry out almost all the functions needed for cells to live. A change to the DNA in a gene can change a protein's amino acids, changing its shape and function. This can have a dramatic effect in the cell and on the organization as a whole. Although genetics plays a large role in the appearance and behavior of organisms, it is the combination of genetics with what an organism experiences that determines the ultimate outcome. For example, while genes play a role in determining a person's height, the nutrition and health that person experiences in childhood also have a large effect. End quote. DNA from the beginning. This is from another internet source. Since the beginning of human history, people have wondered how traits are inherited from one generation to the next. Although children often look more like one parent than the other, most offspring seem to be a blend of the characteristics of both parents. Centuries of breeding of domestic plants and animals had shown that useful traits, speed in horses, strength in oxen, and larger fruits and crops can be accentuated by controlled mating. However, there was no scientific way to predict the outcome of a cross between two particular parents. It was not until 1865 that an Augustinian monk named Gregor Mendel found that individual traits are determined by discrete factors, later known as genes, which are inherited from the parents. His rigorous approach transformed agricultural breeding from an art to a science. Mendel started with parents of known genetic background to provide a baseline against which to compare patterns of inheritance in the resulting offspring. Then he carefully counted the numbers of individuals showing the various traits in successive generations of offspring. End quote. It should be noted that Gregor Mendel was using a system of selective breeding rather than crossbreeding, and the two are as different as day is from night. So when a young white man looks for a wife, he should select rather than cross over. National Human Genome Research Institute. What is DNA? We all know that elephants only give birth to little elephants, giraffes to giraffes, dogs to dogs, and so on, for every type of living creatures. But why is this so? The answer lies in a molecule called deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, which contains the biological instructions that make each species unique. DNA, along with the instructions it contains, is passed from adult organisms to their offspring during reproduction. Where is DNA found? DNA is found inside a special area of the cell called the nucleus. Because the cell is very small and because organisms have many DNA molecules per cell, each DNA molecule must be tightly packaged. This packaged form of the DNA is called a chromosome. DNA spends a lot of time in its chromosome form, but during cell division, DNA unwinds so it can be copied, and the copies transferred to new cells. DNA also unwinds so that its instructions can be used to make proteins and for other biological processes. Researchers refer to DNA found in the cell's nucleus as nuclear DNA. An organism's complete set of nuclear DNA is called its genome. Besides the DNA located in the nucleus, humans and other complex organisms also have a small amount of DNA in cell structures known as mitochondria. Mitochondria generate the energy the cell needs to function properly. In sexual reproduction, organisms inherit half of their nucleus DNA from the male parent and half from the female parent. However, organisms inherit all their mitochondria DNA from the female parent. This occurs because only egg cells and not sperm cells keep their mitochondria during fertilization. What is DNA made of? DNA is made of chemical building blocks called nucleotides. These building blocks are made of three parts: a phosphate group, a sugar group, and one of four types of nitrogen bases. To form a strand of DNA, nucleotides are linked into chains, with the phosphate and sugar groups alternating. The four types of nitrogen bases found in nucleotides are adenine, A, thymine, T, guanine, G, and cytosine, C. The order or sequence of these bases determines what biological instructions are contained in a strand of DNA. For example, the sequence ATCGTT might instruct for blue eyes, while ATCGCT might instruct for brown. Each DNA sequence that contains instructions to make a protein is known as a gene. The size of a gene may vary greatly, ranging from about 1,000 bases to 1,000,000 bases in humans. The complete DNA instruction book, or genome, for a human contains about 3 billion bases and about 20,000 genes on 23 pairs of chromosomes. End quote. Science knows today that each single cell of the human body has two sets of 23 chromosomes, or a total of 46. I will now quote the World Book Encyclopedia, Volume 9, page 192D. Every human body cell contains two sets of 23 chromosomes. These two sets look very much alike. Each chromosome in one set can be matched with a particular chromosome in the other set. Egg cells and sperm cells have only one set of 23 chromosomes. These cells are formed in a special way and end up with only half the number of chromosomes found in body cells. As a result, when an egg and a sperm come together, the fertilized egg cell will contain the 46 chromosomes of a normal body cell. Half of the chromosomes come from the mother and half from the father. End quote. So when Paul states at Corinthians 6:14, King James Version, "Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers," or as William Fink translates it, "Do not become yoked together with untrustworthy aliens," this happens when 23 chromosomes are supplied by a white Adamic man and 23 chromosomes are supplied by a non-white alien woman or an alien non-white man with a white Adamic woman. Truly, this amounts to communion of light with darkness, and touch not the unclean means to have no sexual contact with them. I hope the reader is beginning to comprehend how some of these New Testament passages pertain to the Old and vice versa. I will use the remaining space to show some examples of this. Paul also referred to the Old Testament at 2 Corinthians 3:6, where he said, "Who also hath made us able ministers of the New Testament, not of the letter, but of the Spirit? For the letter killeth, but the Spirit giveth life." Let's now compare this to Jeremiah 31:31-32, to which Paul was referring here. "Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was an husband unto them, saith Yahweh. Paul was addressing the Corinthians as lost Israelites, not some kind of heathen Gentiles. Actually, Paul was taking the promised new covenant to the Corinthian Israelites. I don't know about your Bible, but mine at 2 Corinthians 3:6 cross-references to Jeremiah 31:31. The truth is, the new covenant is for the house of Israel and the house of Judah only. To allocate the new covenant to whosoever is fraud, unless the whosoever happens to be of Israel or of Judah. Paul also referred to Isaiah 53:6, 9, and at 2 Corinthians 5:21, writing, "For he hath made him to be sin for us, who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him." Isaiah 53:6 and 9 states, "All we like sheep have gone astray, we have turned every one to his own way, and Yahweh hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. And he made his grave with the wicked, and with the rich in his death, because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth." I don't know about your Bible, but mine cross-references 2 Corinthians 5:21 with Isaiah 53:6 and 9. We have to ask the question, why did Paul quote this passage in Isaiah unless the people to whom he was addressing were Corinthian Israelites? It makes no sense otherwise. There are some today who make the claim that Paul was not a true apostle but a fraud. They go so far as to ignore all his epistles. If they read any of Paul's writings, it is for the purpose of criticism. But let's see what Paul wrote in his epistle to the Romans. At Romans 1, 1 and 2, "I, Paul, a servant of Yahshua Christ, called to be an apostle, separated unto the gospel of God, which he had promised afore by his prophets in the Holy Scriptures." To be noticed here is the phrase, "separated unto the gospel of God," which is similar to the language found at Numbers 16:9, Deuteronomy 10:8, Isaiah 49:1, and Jeremiah 1:5. These four passages are cited by the New Treasury of Scriptural Knowledge, a book of thousands of cross-references. Numbers 16:9, "Seemeth it but a small thing unto you, that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the service of the tabernacle of Yahweh, and to stand before the congregation to minister unto them." Deuteronomy 10:8, "At that time Yahweh separated the tribe of Levi to bear the ark of the covenant of Yahweh, to stand before Yahweh to minister unto him, and to bless in his name unto this day." Isaiah 49:1, "Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people, from far. Yahweh hath called me from the womb, from the bowels of my mother hath he made mention of my name." Jeremiah 1:5, "Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. And before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee, and I ordained thee a prophet unto the nations." By the time of Paul, the Levitical priesthood was a thing of the past, and the entire load of the gospel fell on the apostles, of which Paul became the chief. Not a chief to rule over the other apostles, but chief in what he was to accomplish among the nations. And like the various leaders and prophets found in the Old Testament, Paul was chosen for the job he did from the foundation of the world. At Romans 1:16, Paul declared to the Romans, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to every one that believeth, to the Judean first and also to the Greek." Here Paul was making reference to Psalm 49 and 10, where David said, "I have preached righteousness in the great congregation. Lo, I have not refrained my lips, O Yahweh, thou knowest. I have not hid thy righteousness within my heart. I have declared thy faithfulness and thy salvation. I have not concealed thy loving kindness and thy truth from the great congregation." I don't know about your Bible, but mine cross-references Romans 1:16, to Psalm 49 and 10. At Romans 1:17, Paul wrote, "For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith." Here Paul was referring to Habakkuk 2:3-4, which says, "For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. Behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith." So that we get the context of Habakkuk 2:3-4, we will go to Adam Clark's commentary. While Clark is blind to Israel identity, and some of his comments are flawed, I believe he is right on the money on these two verses. Verse 3, the vision is yet for an appointed time. The Chaldeans, who are to ruin Judea, shall afterward be ruined themselves. But they must do this work before they receive their wages. Therefore the vision is for an appointed time. But at the end it shall speak, when his work of devastation is done, his day of retribution shall take place. Though it tarry, though it would appear to be long, do not be impatient, it will surely come. It will not tarry longer than the prescribed time, and this time is not far distant. Wait for it. Verse 4, behold his soul which is lifted up. He that presumes on his safety without any special warrant from God is a proud man, and whatever he may profess or think of himself, his mind is not upright in him. But he that is just by faith shall live. He that believes what God hath said relative to the Chaldeans besieging Jerusalem shall make his escape from the place and consequently shall save his life. The words in the New Testament are accommodated to the salvation which believers in Christ shall possess. Indeed, the just, the true Christians, who believed in Jesus, sic Yahshua Christ's words relative to the destruction of Jerusalem, when they found the Romans coming against it, left the city and escaped to Pella in Coele-Syria, and did live their lives were saved, while the unbelieving Jews to a man either perished or were made slaves. One good sense is, he that believes the promises of God and has found life through believing shall live by his faith. End quote. It is paramount that we understand the passage in the Old Testament that Paul referred to at Romans 1:17 and the historical setting that surrounded it and apply it to Paul's time. Paul knew ahead of time, at Romans 16:20, that the satanic bad fig Jews were going to be uprooted and many destroyed or made slaves. So Paul admonished the Romans, as Christ had admonished the good fig Judeans, that when they would observe all of this happening, that they should live by faith. Although Paul prophesied all of this, he would not live long enough to see Jerusalem's final destruction, which shall never rise again. That the Romans should live by faith is in perfect accord with the divine decree at Habakkuk 2:4, the just shall live by his faith. Acts 1:18 shows Paul's reason for referring to Habakkuk. Many are not aware of the difference between a good fig Judean and a bad fig Jew. The good figs of Judah were those who kept their genetics pure, while the bad figs were Judeans who mixed their seed with the Canaanites. End of Watchman's Teaching Letter number 124. Thank you for listening.